The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Derek Dreyer, and I am the director of the Rosenbach Museum and Library here in Philadelphia. This past spring, as I suspect some of you know, the Rosenbach and the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation announced their intent to merge, a step that will create one of the greatest collections of literature and history anywhere in the world. The Rosenbach is, of course, home to rare items from some of Ireland's most acclaimed writers, including Bram Stoker's Notes for Dracula, and among our premier treasures, the manuscript of James Joyce's Ulysses. The Rosenbach celebrates Joyce, who has been called the greatest 20th century novelist writing in English, annually on Bloomsday, that's June 16, with special programs and exhibitions, and the museum displays selections from the Ulysses manuscript year-round. Now, there are probably some of you in the audience who would take issue with the notion of Joyce being a novelist, and probably many more who would take issue with the notion of Joyce writing in English. But well, let's not worry about those things, because we're not here to talk about James Joyce. We're here to welcome Colm McCann. Tonight's author continues in the great Irish literary tradition. His 2009 National Book Award-winning novel, Let the Great World Spin, has been compared to Joyce's Ulysses and was described by John Lester in the New York Times as one of the most electric, profound novels I have read in years. McCann joins us tonight to share his new novel, Transatlantic, a book that spans centuries, oceans, and continents while interlacing fact and fiction through the lives of abolitionist Frederick Douglass, Senator George Mitchell, and aviation pioneers John Alcock and Arthur Brown. Michiko Kakutani of the New York Times describes Transatlantic as an affecting novel about the ways the tsunami of history can sideswipe people or lift them to unexpected heights. A book that features stories of hope and survival that are played out against the vast backlit diorama of a century and a half of Irish American history. Now, I know you didn't come here to listen to me this evening, so we're going to move to the main act in just a moment. But before we get started, please join me in silencing your cell phones. And I'd also like to remind you that flash photography is not permitted during tonight's event. Following the lecture, a book signing will take place upstairs in the lobby. And don't forget that most of the author events programs are available as podcasts at freelibrary.org. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Colm McCann to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Hello. Thank you, Derek. Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for coming out. This beautiful night, I brought the Irish weather with me. And funny enough, it actually it has been really warm in Ireland for the last 3 weeks. And I was back there thinking about the Rosenbach, the museum, and I was thinking maybe I can sell them a copy of my Transatlantic. I've been carrying this since the book was published about 6 weeks ago or 7 weeks ago. And I was looking through it back there. It's really awful. I got like receipts in here, and I got people, and people come along and scribble on it, and they write on it. So you're actually, everybody is welcome to scribble in my book tonight. The funniest dedication I ever got. Look, what is this? It's like a napkin with a peace symbol on it. And what's that doing there? I don't know. Anyway, The funniest dedication I ever got was with my friend and colleague, Peter Carey, when he was coming out with Parrot and Olivier. And I went to this this reading, and afterwards I went up and I bought the book and did everything. And I was doing, you know, and Peter looks at me, he says, "Come on, man." I says, what am I going to say? I said, "I don't care. Just write something. Sign your name. Write something." So he did, and I went home, and I opened up when I got home, and he had said, "For column, sorry for writing in your book, Peter Carey." So there it is. So please write in my book. I mean, there's all sorts of people have signed it too. I have friends who've done it, and my kids have done it, and then I have right here. I have Jerry Adams. That was pretty funny. I was reading about the peace process in Dublin, and I look up at the queue at the end of the night, and Jerry Adams is right there in the back of the queue, and so that was it. And Gabriel Byrne, and you see, there's always a collective sigh. Why aren't you Gabriel Byrne? Terrible. But what we're going to do tonight is I'm going to read for about 20 minutes or so and chat to you about this novel, Transatlantic, and then I'm going to open it up for questions and comments and whatever else. I'm at the tail end of my book tour. The book tour got so crazy at one stage that I ended up brushing my teeth with Ben Gay. I swear, I kid you not. It was like... It was actually an Irish form of Bengay. It was deep heat. And I was like, oh, man. It's like, this toothpaste is weird. It's like... I was on fire for the rest of the day. So it's nice to be sort of approaching the end, if there's ever an end to anything at all. And so the beginning, then, of this book actually came from a deep desire to write about a story that just completely corralled me, sort of knocked me sideways. And I suppose that's what we do. We write towards our obsessions, and we write what we want to know. And I had heard that the great American statesman and abolitionist, author, women's rights activist, and slave, Frederick Douglass, had gone to Ireland in 1845 to lecture on the circuit. And they'd sent him to Ireland because they were afraid that he was going to be kidnapped, that his owners, quote-unquote, in Maryland were going to kidnap him again and make a spectacle out of his fame. And so he was really going to England to make money for the abolitionist cause and to sell his book, Narrative of the Life of a Slave. So they sent him to Ireland in advance. But he said that when he went to Ireland, he said, "I'm here under the emerald skies, and lo, the chattel becomes a man." He felt a sort of freedom that happened for him. But it was very contradictory. At the same time as all this freedom was unfurling for him, the Irish famine was unfurling at his feet. And he didn't say anything publicly about it. He did in privately in letters, but never publicly. And there was a great tension there. I thought it was a beautiful story. It broke my heart, but that was the story. It's like, oh, Jesus, but I don't want to write a novel that's... an historical novel, because it seems to preserve things in aspic. People seem to think that the kid gloves are on or something, and that, you know, it's almost like, you know, oh, it's an historical novel, you know. I don't even like the term all that much. So, and I knew I wanted to shove it up against the present. And so what was Douglass doing? Well, it was a form of taking the war out of the machine, taking the moral war out of the machine of slavery. That's what he was doing. And then I thought, for years I've wanted to write about the Irish peace process because I think it's one of our great stories. We've lots of crappy stories, including the Celtic Tiger and all that stuff. I can hear some Irish people. There's some Irish people who know exactly what I'm talking about in the audience. But I wanted to write about that great story that we achieved at the end of the 20th century and now for 15 years following was the peace process. So I decided to write about Senator George Mitchell. And between Douglas and Mitchell, two great American statesmen making these transatlantic, these vast transatlantic voyages, I had no clue what I wanted to do. Like, how the hell do I get from one to the other? And then I sort of like halfway in between 1919, I was doing some research and a little bit of shuffling through the memory, and then I recalled that the very first transatlantic non-stop voyage by airplane was done by Alcock and Brown, who were two British RAF men who'd come out of that terrible bath of dying, which was the First World War. And they too were trying to take the war out of the machine in the sense that they replaced, they had a Vickers Vimy, and they replaced the bomb bays. Vimy is a bomber. And they replaced the bomb bays with petrol tanks in order that they could navigate the space between North America and Europe. Kind of like, at that stage, landing a man on the moon. And this airplane is basically like a little glider, like a paper glider, more or less. It's made of linen. The wings were made of Irish linen, and held together with wood and struts and a few metal bolts and two Rolls-Royce engines. Open cockpit, and they flew across the ocean. I've already given the story away, but this is just the first chapter. And they're about to come into Ireland. They're about to get an Irish welcome. Brown can feel it rising up in him, a prospect of grass, a lonesome cottage on the horizon, perhaps a row of huddled cattle. They must be careful. There are high cliffs along the coast. He has studied the geography of Ireland, the hills, the round towers, the expanses of limestone, the disappearing lakes, Galway Bay. There had been songs about that during the war, the roads to Tipperary. The Irish were a sentimental lot. They died and drank in great numbers. A few of them for empire. Drank and died, died, drank. He is screwing back the lid on the flask of hot tea when he feels Alcock's hand on his shoulder, and he knows before turning around that it is there, as simple as that, rising up out of the sea, as nonchalant as you like, wet rock, dark grass, stone, tree, light, two islands. The plane crosses the land at a low clip, and down below, a sheep with a magpie sitting on its back. The sheep raises its head and begins to run when the plane swoops, and for just a moment, the magpie stays in place on the sheep's back. It is something so odd that Brown knows he will remember it forever. The miracle of the actual. In the distance, the mountains, the quilt work of stone walls, corkscrew roads, stunted trees, an abandoned castle, a pig farm, a church, and there, the radio towers to the south, 200-foot masts in a rectangle of lockstep, some warehouses, a stone house sitting on the edge of the Atlantic. It is Clifton, then, Clifton. The Marconi towers, a great net of radio masts. They glance at each other. No words. Bring her down. Bring her down. They follow their line out over the village. The houses are grey, the roofs slate, the streets unusually quiet. Alcock whoops. He shuts the engines. He angles in, flattens the Vimy out. Their helmets applaud. Their hair roars. Their fingernails whistle. And from out of the grass, a flock of long-billed snipe rises and soars. It looks to them like the perfect landing field, hard and level and green. Yet what they don't notice coming down are the nearby slabs of peat that lie like cake. the sharp cuts in the brown earth, the lines of wet string that run along the banks, the triangular ricks of earth off in the distance. They miss, too, the wooden turf carts that lie weathered and rain-pocked at the side of the road. They miss the angles of the slains leaning up against the carts. They miss the rushes grown long on the abandoned roads. They bring the vimy towards the ground, a flawless trajectory, almost as if they could lean out and scoop up the soil in their hands. Here we are. The plane suspends itself a foot from the ground. Their hearts thump in their shirts. They wait for the moment of touch. They skim the top of the grass. They hit and bounce. We are down. We are down, Jackie boy. But they know straight away that they are slowing too suddenly. A wheel, maybe. A burst tire. A snap of tail fin, no cursing, no shouting, no panic, a sinking feeling, a dip, and then they realise it is bog, not grass. Welcome to Ireland, lads. They were British soldiers after all, right? Gotcha. The living roots of sedge, they are skidding across a green bog. The soil holds the weight of the plane a moment and they skid 50 feet, 60 feet, 70, but then the wheels dig. The earth holds, the vimy sinks, the nose dips, the tail lifts. It is as if they've been yanked backwards by surprise. The front of the vimy slams into the soil, the back end flips. Brown smashes his face on the front of the cockpit. Alcock pushes back against the rudder control bar and bends it with pure force. A shot of pain through his chest and shoulders. Good Jesus, Jackie, what happened there? Have we crashed? The silence and noise in their heads. Louder now than ever, suddenly doubled somehow. And then a relief floods up through them. The noise filters down into the rest of their bodies. Is that silence? Is that really silence? The racket of it, slipping through their skull boxes. Good God, Teddy, that's silence. That's what it sounds like. Brown touches his nose, his chin, his teeth to see if he's intact. A few cuts, a few bruises, nothing else. We're alive. We're perpendicular, but we're alive. The vimy sticks out of the earth like some new world dolman. The nose is buried at least 2 feet in the bog, the tail in the air. Crikey, says Alcock. He can smell petrol somewhere. He switches off the magnetos. Quick, out, down. Brown reaches for the logbook, the flares, the linen bag of letters. He pulls himself over the edge of the cockpit. He throws down his walking stick and it hits like an arrow in the bog below, stuck sideways in the soil, a burn in his leg as he lands. Hallelujah for the ground. It almost surprises him that it isn't made of air. A living dolman, yes. In the pocket of his flight suit, Brown has a small pair of binoculars. The right lens is fogged, but through the good lens he sees figures high-stepping across the bog. Soldiers. Yes, soldiers. They seem for all the world like toy things coming, dark against the complicated Irish sky. As they get closer, he can make out the shape of their hats and the slide of rifles across their chests and the bounce of bandolier belts. There's a war going on, he knows. But there's always some sort of war going on in Ireland, isn't there? One never knows quite whom or what to trust. Don't shoot, he thinks. After all this, don't shoot us. Excuse me, 99. But these are his own. British, he is sure of it. One of them with a camera bobbing at his chest, another still in his striped pyjamas. Behind them, in the distance, horses and carts and a single motor car. A line of people coming from the town, snaking out along the road, small grey figures. And look at that. Look at that. A priest in white vestments, coming closer now. Men, women, children, running in their Sunday best. Ah, Mass. So they must have been at Mass. That's why there was nobody on the streets. The smell of the earth, so astoundingly fresh, it strikes Brown like a thing he might eat. His ears throb. His body feels as if it's still moving through the air. He is, he thinks, the first man ever to fly and stand at the exact same time. The war is out of the machine. He holds the small bag of letters up in salute. On they come, soldiers, people, the light drizzle of grey. Ireland, a beautiful country. A bit savage on a man, all the same. Ireland. So that's the first chapter. No, thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. I actually went out to North Dakota with another writer, Scott Olson, and he arranged a fly-in lesson for me. And he told me, he says, I wanted to feel like what it was like to be up in a small plane and be piloting a small plane, and you know, and we did it and turned off the engines and we glided and everything. But he said to me beforehand, you will know if you're a pilot when the minute you touch down, you want to go back up again. And the minute I touched down, I didn't want ever to go back up again. I was dreadful. I was just dreadful. But I mean, I suppose that's the beauty of writing, is that we get to do these things and get to imagine these things and make them real. Joyce said that he wanted to recreate life out of life, which is a beautiful notion. That we take this life that we live and then recreate it on the page. And that's much of my own philosophy. I was just talking with a number of very interesting people, supporters of a group called Narrative 4. I just had dinner with them here in Philadelphia this evening. And we were talking about this idea of embracing otherness and becoming other and children telling other people's stories. Maybe I'll get a chance to talk about it later on this evening. But for me, the great beauty is that I don't have to be myself. I mean, I wake up in the morning and look at myself in the mirror and say, Jesus, I have to like hang around with you for the next 24 hours. But what I really love is not being me and becoming absolutely someone else. And that's the great dignity of writing fiction. And I was going to read a sad part about Douglas being in Ireland and coming upon the famine, but I'm not. I'm going to read something else. This is Douglas, Frederick Douglas, in Ireland. And first of all, I'm going to read a piece for five lines that he wrote himself, although one of the lines is my own. I'm going to confound scholars by pretending that some of Douglas's stuff was actually his. It's really true. So he said, I prefer to be true to myself, even at the hazard of incurring the ridicule of others, rather than to be false and incur my own abhorrence. From my earliest recollection, I date the entertainment of a deep conviction that slavery would not always be able to hold me within its foul embrace. And now, in this long curve of this journey, I find myself spinning a new strand, and I appeal to you, gentlemen, to strive against the despotism, bigotry, and tyranny of those who might refuse me entry to this very room. At the end of his second week in Dublin, he wrote to Anna to say that he hadn't been called a nigger on Irish soil, not once. Not yet, anyway. He was hailed most everywhere he went. He wasn't sure what to make of it. It baffled him. There was something crystallizing in him. He felt for the first time ever, maybe, that he could properly inhabit his skin. There was a chance that he was just a curio to them, but something in him felt aligned to those he met, and in all his 27 years, he hadn't seen anything quite like it. He wished she could be there to witness it. It was a cold, grey country under a hat of rain, but he could take the middle of the footpath or board a stagecoach or hail a hansom without apology. There was poverty everywhere, yes, but still he would take the poverty of a free man. No whips, no chains, no branding marks. He was, of course, travelling in high company, but even on the roughest streets he had not heard any vitriol. He attracted a ferocious stare or two, but perhaps it was also because of the rather high cut at the back of his coat. Webb had told him already that he could perhaps afford a tad more modesty. And see, the thing about it is, Douglas was gorgeous. I mean, he's 27 years old, and he's different. And all the Victorian women of Ireland wanted to have a picnic with him, you know. But he also was a dandy, and he was an intellectual, and he cared about people and had a deep empathy. But he had a big ego as well. And he's there with his publisher, Richard Webb. And I wanted to try and capture a little bit of the humor, a little bit of the tension between him and his publisher. And this small scene tries to do that. Richard Webb is a Quaker, an Irish Quaker, who looked after Douglas quite well, but they butted heads quite a deal too. The bell on the door sounded out long and lazy. The tailor looked up, but the shop continued its business. That's what surprised Douglas the most, the absence of alarm, no shock, no scurry. He walked along the rack of coats. The tailor finally came from behind the counter and shook his hand. You're welcome to my establishment, sir. Thank you. You're the talk of the town, sir. I'm interested in a new jacket.
Certainly, sir.
And a longer cut of coat, said Webb. I'm quite capable of dressing myself, said Douglas. They glared at each other across the gulf of the room. Gentlemen, said the tailor, come this way. Webb stepped across, but Douglas put his hand on his chest. The air froze. Webb lowered his eyes and gave the faint hint of a smile. He took out a wallet of Morocco leather and rubbed the length of it and inserted it into his jacket pocket. As you wish. Douglas stepped, large and loud-footed, with the tailor towards a rear room. Scissors, needles, cutouts, dusty L's and bolts of cloth spooled across the tables. What fields did that cloth come from? What fingers had spun it out? The tailor whisked a looking glass across the room. The mirror was on a stand mounted with wheels. He had never been measured by a white man before. The tailor stood behind him. Douglas flinched a moment when the tape was put around his neck. Sorry, sir, is the tape cold? He closed his eyes. He allowed the measurements, his rib cage, his chest, his waist. He raised his arms in the air to see how deep the armpit could go. He breathed in, breathed out, allowed the tattered yellow tape along his inseam. The tailor scribbled the measurements down. The handwriting was fine and exact. When he was finished, the tailor wrapped his fingers around Douglas's shoulders, gripped him hard. You're a fine, broad man, sir, I'll venture that. To tell you the truth, he glanced at Webb at the front of the shop. The Quaker was standing at the window looking out an overseer. The Liffey seemed to want to carry him away on its continuous sleeve of grey. I'd be rather grateful, said Douglas. Yes, sir. He looked out at Webb again. If you'd fit me also for a camel's hair vest.
A vest, sir?
Yes, a waistcoat, I believe you call it. Indeed, sir. The tailor turned him round once more, busied himself with a measurement of Douglas's ribcage, brought the ends of the tape together at the navel. You can put it on Mr. Webb's bill. Yes, sir. He's always been fond of a surprise. Okay, and last, before we go into... I have an incredible admiration for Senator George Mitchell. I always have done. I thought it was really weird when I heard back in the 1990s that a 64-year-old man had gone to Ireland and had stayed there or travelled there and stayed there most of each week to help us negotiate our peace process while at home. He had just entered a new marriage and had a five-month-old baby. And I thought, wow, what a spectacular image that is. And what sort of tension must it have been for this great man, who was once the second most powerful man in the United States after Bill Clinton, because he was Speaker of the House, to go across and to listen to the Irish. And as you know, you can tell, all right, tonight, the Irish just never shut up. Right? They're going on and on and on, especially up north. Is there anyone from Northern Ireland? My mum's from Northern Ireland, so I'm allowed to say this. They just go on and on and on. For 700 years, Mr. Chairman, I 543 years ago, they came into my field, you know. And he sat there did Senator George Mitchell, along with numerous other people, because the peace process belonged to many, many, many people, he sat there and listened, and that was his great dignity. And I want to read two short sections of the this piece about the peace process, because it is a novel about peace. And this is where Mitchell himself, because I got to know him after I had imagined him, talks about the women. And women become really powerful in the book later on, in the second half of the book. I know I've only read about the men tonight, but really the novel belongs to women. And this is a foreshadowing of this. He's talking about the peace process. He's well aware that there are some out there who think that they have him on an endless looping string, the judicial puppet, peace and duty. But it doesn't bother him one bit, even when they draw him glum and dangling in one of their crude newspaper cartoons or their backhanded jibes. There's something fierce about him. He has earned the right to part the darkness slightly, to go with them into the corners. What the Irish themselves worry about is that they will somehow keep on delaying, but he will not allow it, the endless river run, river run, river run. He will be over 80 years old when Andrew goes to college, the father mistaken for the grandfather, the distant ancestry, all those ancient ghosts. There were 61 children born in Northern Ireland the day that Andrew was born. 61 ways for a life to unfold. The thought slides a sharp blade of regret down the core of his spine. His son is just 5 months old now, and he can count on four hands the amount of days he has spent with him. How many hours has he sat in the stark chambers listening to men argue about a single comma or the placement of a period, when all he wanted was to return to the surprise of his very young child? Sometimes he would watch them as they talked, saying very little or nothing at all, kites of language, clouds of logic drifting in and out, caught on the moving wave of their own voices. He heard certain phrases and allowed them to take him over the treetops into what the Northern Irish call the yonder. Immersed in the words, sitting at the plenaries waiting, the brittleness in the room, the cramped maleness, a relentless solicitude about them. They would hold up a hand and tell people they did not deserve the reverence, no. But it was plain to see that they needed it. Some days he wishes he could empty the chambers of men, fill the halls instead with women. The short, sharp shock of 3,200 mothers, the ones who picked through the supermarket debris for pieces of their dead husbands, the ones who still laundered their gone son's bed sheets by hand, the ones who kept an extra teacup at the end of the table in case of miracles, the elegant ones, the angry ones, the clever ones, the ones in hairnets, the ones exhausted by all this dying. They carried their sorrow, not with photos under their arms or with public wailing or by beating their chests, but with their weariness around their eyes. Mothers and daughters and children and grandmothers too. They never fought the wars, but they suffered them, the women, blood and bone. How many times has he heard it? How often were there two ways to say just one thing? My son died, his name was Seamus. My son died, his name was James. My son died, his name was Patter. My son died, his name was Pete. My son died, his name was Billy. My son died, his name was Liam. My son died, his name was Charles. My son died, his name was Cahill. My son's name is Andrew. And now the beautiful thing the beautiful, beautiful thing about the peace process and his relationship with Andrew is that he can look at his son and he knows how long the peace process has held by looking at his son and knowing that his son is 13, 14, now 15 years old. I think that's an amazing thing. I think he's an incredible man. A lot of people deserve credit, including Clinton, including Adams, including McGuinness. I hate to say it, even Paisley. He was the architect. He was the one behind it. And I wanted to write a myth, and this is just a half page, and I'll finish on this. a myth for his experience. Because it seemed to me that his great generosity was like allowing all this language to come in on top of him and almost drown him, and then being able to turn and say, okay, enough. It's time for peace. Which is a great story. It's a hard story to write about. Writing about peace is much more difficult than writing about war. Because peace, you know, it's like, it's airy and it's like, you know, and people, some people think it's sentimental, you know, like, and but it's not. You know, war has all those like burned out hotels and carcasses and bullets and all these things. But peace is, you know, and the thing about war is like, and I said this in the New York Times editorial, that for war to occur, a bullet need only happen once. But for peace to occur, it has to happen again and again and again. Its difficulty is its sort of ongoingness, but it's also its beauty in a certain way. And I think Mitchell recognized that. And that's why I think he's one of the great Americans of our times. So this is just a small piece about trying to write a myth for the Northern Irish peace process. It is as if in a myth he has visited an empty grain silo. In the beginning he stood at the bottom of the silo in the resounding dark. Several figures gathered at the very top. They peered down, shaded their eyes, began to drop their pieces of grain upon him. Words. A small rain at first, full of vanity and history and rancor. Clattering in the emptiness, he stood and he let it sound metallic around him until it began to pour down and the grain took on a different sound, and he had to reach up and keep knocking the words aside just to get a little space to breathe. Dust and chaff in the air all around him from their very own fields. They were pouring down their winnowed bitterness. And in his silence, he just kept thrashing, spluttering, pushing the words away, a refusal to drown. But what nobody noticed, not even himself, was that the grain kept rising and the silo filled and he kept rising with it and the sounds grew different. Word upon word falling around him, building beneath him, and now at the top of the silo, he has clawed himself up and dusted himself off and he stands there equal with the pourers who are astounded by the language that lies below them. They glance at each other. There are three ways down. From this silo, they can fall into the grain and they can drown. They can jump off the edge and abandon it, or they can learn to sow it very slowly at their feet. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I stole a watch earlier on. I'm in the business of traveling around the country now, like stealing people's watches, pretending I don't have a watch for to figure out. But we got it right on time.
It's yours now.
Yeah, right. So we're going to open it up for questions or comments, and you know, talk about transatlantic or Let the Great World Spin or Philly or the Barnes Museum or whatever it is that we can talk about.
Please raise your hand and we'll get a microphone right to you. We'll start right here in green.
First, I want to thank you for, I've read great Let the Great World Spin and Transatlantic. They're just brilliant novels. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And what's magical for me about reading them was the interconnectedness of the characters in both books in different ways. So you're, as I read the book, I would suddenly, you would reveal that a character that you're reading about is actually related in some way to someone else you've been reading about. Mm-hmm. And as I read it, I just marveled that at the way you'd done that and wondered if you knew those, how did you figure out the connections? Did you have it all in your head when you started, or did it come to you as you worked on the stories? It was so powerful, and so it communicated the connectedness of people all over the world as I read it.
Thank you so much, and thank you for the question, and indeed for the comment. I will say to you that I've begun to think of it this way. I don't really know what it is that I'm doing, I know that disappoints some people sometimes. Like, it's like, oh, Jesus, I thought he was smart, and he's not. You know, he's actually thick. But for me, part of the beauty of all of this is doing it and then finding out the stuff as you go along. So I don't have a map. I have no map whatsoever. And in fact, I don't even chart these things out or graph them out at all. I try to hold them all in my head and they sort of occur. And the only way that I can tell you what it feels like is that it feels a bit like, because this was a really hard novel for me to write. I had a really hard time with it. And I was not the happiest person at times, like trying to do it, and I drove some people crazy. But it feels like you want to be an explorer, right? And you want to be discovering some new land, some sort of new human connection or whatever it happens to be, or something old that nobody's really written about before. And every day you go out in a little boat and you more or less capsize every single day. And then another day you get drifted off in a current and you get smashed up and shipwrecked. But one day you go out and then you find this little island. And then you start to explore that island, and then you meet these creatures that are on the island and their characters, and they sort of introduce you and they pull you along. And the beauty of it for me then is that I discover all these things as I go along. And I discover what it was that I knew, but I wasn't entirely aware of. So it's a process of sort of embracing one's consciousness, letting go with mystery. But there has to be some intention behind it. You have to know, well, you know, I want to write about grace, or I want to write about recovery, or I want to do a 9/11 analogy, or I want to talk about peace. You know, that's the thing that's behind it all. But you don't want to be too aware of it. So it's a long answer to a very kind question. And really, what happens to me is that I just sort of go off on a journey. And most of the time, when I'm finished a novel, like now, I think I'll never be able to do it again.
Hope not. Next question. How about right here along the side?
I too read the last two, and now I went on Amazon and got the other six.
Whoa.
So how would you suggest go through those? should I do them chronologically, or do you have a favorite that I should start with, or what's your suggestion?
It's so funny. It's like having kids, and you know, I have this joke that I have with my kids. I have Isabella, John Michael, and Christian, and hanging around and say, Isabella, love you. John Michael, love you. Christian, like you a lot. I suppose it's the same, you know. But really, when you love them all equally. But I have a little book that is probably my least known book that I have a great fondness for. It's a thing called Everything in This Country Must. It's about Northern Ireland, and actually, there's a little film. On my website, you can see the film that was done by a guy called Gary McHenry. Really, the novel you should care about the most is the one that you're about to do, and then the one that you've just finished. But in terms of reading them in any particular order, I wouldn't suggest any particular order except the order that they sort of fall into your lap.
A woman in third row back in the white.
First of all, thank you so much, because I enjoyed your last two novels immensely. And I was wondering, you really seem to have gotten into the heart of mothers who have lost children in war. And it just seemed to me that you would have had to known someone, that you would have had some kind of a personal experience because of the way that you were able to write about it.
I've been thinking about this a lot very recently. And in Let the Great World Spin, there is a section that says, where Claire, who loses her son in Vietnam, she says to her husband, Solomon, that there is no word for a mother or a father who's lost their child. Because if you're a child, you're an orphan. If you're a woman, you become a widow when you lose someone, or a man becomes a widower. But there is no word that I know of, anyway, in the English language that describes a parent who has lost a child. And I realized only you know, I didn't even know it, that Let the Great Will Spin had that significantly, and also this book has it significantly. And really, the next book that I want to write kind of has it too. And I'm almost thinking that that if I discover a word for it, that will be the title of the book. Is there any reason that I do so? I mean, I have no idea. My mom and dad are still alive. They're in Dublin. You know, I lost a friend earlier this year, Brendan Burke, who's a photographer. I actually read Ulysses to him while he was lying there in his coffin, about to go off. But I read him the naughty bits from Molly Bloom's in the play. In terms of like being able to pinpoint where I might understand that or not, I don't know, except for the fact that I'm a father, and I think that everybody sort of knows these things, and you don't have to necessarily have experienced them in order to be able to write about them. But I would like to know from anybody if they know of a word in any other language that describes, because I'm surely there is a word in, say, maybe Dutch or in French or Spanish for a parent who has lost a child, but, and I might be wrong, but I've looked for a word in English, and I don't think there is one. Not a proper one yet, anyway. There's one lady right at the very back. You can shout out.
Me?
I think we have the lady over here on the...
I would just like to ask you, obviously the women in your novel were as strong as the men, and I know you talked about the men, but did you have a favorite woman strong character in your novel Transatlantic?
Okay. For whatever reason, I like and feel more comfortable writing about... writing in the voices of women. I suppose, you know, I was writing these narratives, and I knew they had to be pulled together, and I knew eventually that it would go towards the women. And in this book, there's actually four generations of women. The woman who finishes off the book for me is the one who I'm closest to, because she talks about the Celtic Tiger. She's there when Obama comes to Dublin. She's there when the Queen comes to Dublin. Like, I don't give too much away about the novel, but... you know, I like her, but then the character of Lily, who is a housemaid in Dublin when Frederick Douglass is there, I kind of have a real fondness for her too. And here's the weird thing about fiction is that, like, you know, I think about some of the women characters that I've created, like Zoli, and say in the last book I did Tilly, who's a 38-year-old hooker in the Bronx. They're all very different, but I kind of think they're alive. Like, so when I go out to the Bronx, I kind of expect to meet Tilly and slip her $10 and say, you know. Or, you know, if I went to northern Italy, that Zoli would still be there. But that's what fiction is about. The fiction is about the creation of the impossible, using the... And the imagination is just as viable as what reality is. And so having imagined something, sometimes it is almost just as real as having literally experienced it. And that's also about the dream world and things like that. And I don't know, maybe I'm a woman trapped in the wrong body or something, but I really like, I feel comfortable writing in the voices of women.
Over on the right-hand side, there's a woman on the aisle, and then the woman in pink will be next.
I just recently read Let the Great World Spin, and I was awed by the language.
Thank you.
It is so wonderful. And I'm wondering a bit about your writing style, at using the words. Do you rewrite a lot? Does it just flow?
I wish it did. No, writing is, what's the old saw? It's like, you know, 99% perspiration. I really believe in the value of hard work. I work really hard. And there is some mystery in it, and you don't know where it comes from. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, I think I kind of had writer's block on this novel, Transatlantic, in a way. But the only way to beat writer's block, if it exists, is to sit your ass down in the seat and fight it. It's the only way to do it, you know? Because you can do other things and pretend. You can go wash the dishes and whatever else it happens to be. No, I never wash the dishes. The fact of the matter is that you have to write in order to do it, and then you have to read it aloud, and then you have to have good people around you whom you can trust and send the things. I mean, I sent parts of my first draft about Douglas to Douglas scholars and people and scholars of Irish history. And I even had bicycles in it in 1845. I thought bicycles were around in 1845, so I had Isabel, the character, riding around on a bicycle in Cork. And a guy comes back to me and says, you know, there was no bicycles until 1880, you know? And so part of it is that, learning to, a little bit of humiliation and other people teaching you, what's true, but also being open to criticism and the fact that you're going to fail as well. I love failure, and it sounds kind of silly, but I like, I find failure to be vivifying. You'd never quite as good as what you wanted it to actually be. So I wish I could say, oh, it all comes out. Sometimes it does. Sometimes you get four or five pages in a day, or you get a perfect paragraph that you just don't ever really want to touch again. That generally happens towards the end of a novel. In the beginning of a novel, there's so many ways that you can go that it's almost, it's terrifying. At the end of a novel, there's really only one way you can go, and so you focus in on it. And I tend, at the end of a novel, to be working at least 8 hours a day, sometimes 14, 15, 16 hours a day. So it's hard work, but good work.
Woman in pink right along the side here. Make that orange.
But it's orange.
It's the dreaded orange.
It's July the 12th.
Now that my mother's dead, I'm permitted to wear this color. All of my life, I was never permitted to wear anything orange.
It's funny.
I wanted to tell you that I have not read your book.
I haven't either. You're all right.
I downloaded it today, and I read the first page while I was sitting here waiting for you to appear. And thank you for explaining what a vimy was, because I hit the dictionary on my Nook, and it come up with no matches.
Mm.
So thank you for explaining what that was.
Sure.
I just returned from Ireland. I was there for 15 days. I've been back for about 10 days now, first time in my lifetime.
I saw you in the airport.
You probably did.
I was there too.
I was there for a long time.
You weren't wearing orange at that stage.
No, I wasn't. I was shown the building where the peace contract was brokered, and it was extremely moving to be there.
Right.
And while I was in Belfast, we stayed in a hotel called the Europa, which is
I'm serious. I stayed in the Europa a couple of weeks ago. What
the
day
most
were you there?
The most bombed hotel.
I was there on July the 2nd and July the 3rd.
It was later than that.
Okay.
I was in Limerick on the 4th of July, so I know.
Yeah, it was the most bombed hotel in the whole of Europe.
Right.
We used to call it the Peace Palace, P-I-E-C-E.
Yes, yeah. So I was told. While I was there in Northern Ireland, in Belfast, we saw a group of Orangemen marching. And I said to somebody, why are they marching? They said, just because their fathers march, they really don't have a cause today.
Right.
It's just part of what they do.
Right.
And I just want to share with you that all of my life, one of my favorite songs, I'm going to fill up again, is Peace in Our Time and for Our Children's Children.
Right.
Faith of Our Fathers, hear us calling, peace in our time. And I hope that this peace stays forever, even though there's a little corner of Ireland that is starting to feel some unrest. And think it, at least that was the impression that I got,
Thank you.
They want to start another uprising.
Yeah.
It may be just a small one, but they want to start something.
No, but I'd say thank you. Thank you for your honesty, and thank you for the depth of your feeling there. The fact of the matter is that the Orange Men are marching, yes, and there are certain kids out in the street, and they are still throwing Molotov cocktails every now and then. But the deep core of Irish society has embraced peace, and I think it's there, and it's there to stay. There's always going to be a rogue element that's going to want to slide the knife in and, like, you know, do their march. But in terms of the marching season and everything like that, I say let them do it. That's fine. You know, as long as they're not, like, taunting people and going through the wrong neighbourhoods and, you know, you can't take all these things away. You have to have a certain amount of generosity to people's cultural background as well. And I think if we do so, we will have a, you know, a long-lasting peace process. I think the kids are learning. As long... They still have segregated schools in Northern Ireland, all that sort of stuff, which is bad. But I think in the long run, what you saw was probably more or less the last kick of a dying horse. I still think that those marches will go on for decades, but they'll become something fun. And maybe the rest of us will also learn, why don't we have an orange parade over here, even if we're green, you know? And that would be the great thing to do. Take away some of the poison about it and sort of re-own it. In fact, and what you're saying is very important, because we're coming up on a very important anniversary in Ireland, 2016, the 100th anniversary of the Irish Uprising. And, you know, if certain things get hijacked, like flags and things like that, there's going to be problems. But hopefully there won't be.
There's a man right here in a black shirt.
That's blue.
Let's call it navy.
Hi. I haven't read any of your books, but like I intend to.
Thank you.
I kind of broke right now, but I'll wait. But what I really want to ask you is if you could list maybe some authors that have influenced your writing, or even like different kinds of art, like music, theater, film,
sure,
visual art, or even history, like things that happen, whatever's influenced your writing, but especially authors, I'd be interested in that.
Well, I'll tell you, the first one that influenced me really was my father. My father was a journalist, and he wrote 27 books, but I will never forget, at the age of about 8 or 9 years old, my dad started writing kids' soccer books about a character called Georgie Good, who's an itinerant who plays in sneakers, plays soccer in sneakers. And he called me out to his writing shed and gave me a big roll of paper and said, will you read this for me? And I edited and commented on his first soccer book. And then I'll never forget when it finally came out, when I was in school in Mr. Kells' class in Fox Rock in the 1970s, early 1970s, Mr. Kells read it out on Friday afternoons, and we would jump on the seats when Georgie Good scored a goal and everything like that. And I don't know if I realised it then, but now I realise that it seemed to me that literature had some sort of power. Then at Christmas, my dad would put on Dylan Thomas, Child's Christmas at Wales, and one of my first really books that influenced me were the collected poems of Dylan Thomas. Then I was reading Ray Bradbury and people like that, and then I got into the Beats, Kerouac and Ferlinghetti and Ginsberg. Nowadays, I love all sorts of things that are going on. There's the stuff from my students. I just did a reading today in New York this afternoon, before I came up here, with one of my students, Jessica Sofer, who wrote a book called Tomorrow There Will Be Apricots. Bill Cheng wrote Southern Cross the Dog. And I love to see when my students do this stuff. And then I adore the work of Michael Ondaatje. He's just the greatest ever. Yes, he deserves like 10 rounds of applause. He's just a beautiful, beautiful writer. John Berger, Peter Carey, Toni Morrison, all sorts of people. You know, I like good literature, and then music too. Yeah, and I'm really into Van Morrison, in fact.
We're gonna take one final question. There's a woman in, I'm gonna call it blue, right there.
That's Cerise.
Thank you. In Let the Great World Spin, which I really did love.
Thank you.
The character Corrigan has the illness TTP. I was wondering what made you choose that illness in the novel, and were you implying that it was connected to AIDS in any way?
Good question. First time I've ever got asked that question, and that book is 4 years old. TTP, I forget how you pronounce it, terminal, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. So I run with a friend of mine, Jim Marion, who's a doctor. He's a gastroenterologist, and I work things out in my novels and so on. And I was writing about Corrigan, and I wanted people to think that Corrigan was a junkie. And so I said to him one morning, what sort of disease would somebody have if they were sick and that the bruises could easily appear on their arm? And TTP is one of those things. And so it was as simple as that, and then I began to research it, and some of the symptoms fit in exactly to the character. And to have a Christ-like figure who's sort of sickly and has a blood disorder and needs a transfusion and doesn't get a transfusion, that was one of the things for me. It was funny because I wrote Let the Great World Spin, I actually got a blood disorder myself. And a weird thing where I was actually on a drip for 6 months, which was crazy. It was like, and it was a form of osteomyelitis, septicemia, whatever it was called. But I'd gotten it from my father's garden. And my father grows roses in Dublin, and I'd been weeding out the garden, and he uses a fertilizer that obviously got into my skin. And I don't know why I'm telling you this story, except... except that it relates to illness, and that you learn these things as you go along. But I'd written about Corrigan's illness long before I myself became ill. But then you stumble on these things all the time, and if they feel right, they feel right. I think that's a good point to say it feels right to cut it off for the evening. Or do you want to do one more? It's up to you.
You want to do one more question? Let's go upstairs for the book signing.
Okay, ladies upstairs for the book signing. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.